You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
With Professor Robert Patman this morning. Morena, Robert. How are you today?
Morena, Rachel. Fine, thank you.
It's good to chat with you. We're going to have a bit of an international look at what's going on in politics at the moment. Let's start with Russia. We've seen quite a sort of specific escalation that's happened in the conflict over the last week. Can you explain what's been happening and why is it significant at the moment?
Well, what we've had is the use of drones by Ukraine, it would appear, to target the Russian capital, Moscow. There's been several drone attacks there. And there's also been attacks by drones in Crimea, which is Russian-occupied. Meanwhile, Russia has stepped up its continuing campaign of missile attacks on civilian infrastructure in Russia. And there's no sign of any lessening of the pace. If anything, the war is getting uglier, so to speak. But I think what was significant this week is that President Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader, said that the war was now being brought to Moscow. And what he meant by that was that Russia is not immune to the consequences of illegally invading a neighbor. And that many Russians may have assumed that this was something that was occurring beyond their borders. But in fact, there's been it's been going on for some time. There's been sabotage. There's been almost nightly explosions in various parts of Russia. But this particular drone attack targeted the very prosperous business sector of Moscow, as well as a defense ministry building. So I think these attacks are designed to do several things. Firstly, to exploit what's now seen as demoralization within the Russian army. Secondly, to, I think, undermine the Putin regime. The Ukrainians have good intelligence about Russia. They know that Putin's position is much weaker after the mutiny by Prigozhin. And I think the third thing is they're trying to influence public opinion in Russia to say, you know, this war is going to have consequences that affect everyone in Russia, not just the leadership. So I think there's a multifaceted design behind these drone attacks on Moscow.
As you said, we're definitely not seeing any sort of slowing down of the conflict at all. But what do you see as being a way out of this situation? What needs to happen for there to be some sort of cease in the conflict?
Well, I think ideally, Mr. Putin has to withdraw his troops back to the internationally recognized boundaries of Russia. He shows no signs of doing that. He occupies illegally 20% of another country's territory. I can't see how a diplomatic settlement can occur in the near future, because otherwise we'd be rewarding Mr. Putin for his aggression. So I think we're engaged, Rachel, in a bit of a grim endgame whereby Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky couldn't survive politically if there was any settlement that handed territory to Russia. The Ukrainians have suffered too much. Huge civilian losses, more than $500 billion worth of damage to Ukraine's infrastructure. The country's almost been wrecked. So they are determined to get back what they consider to be their territory. And what's happened is we're engaged in a counter-offensive at the moment. There are rumours that China is stepping up its support for Ukraine, and there doesn't seem to be any lack, diminishing of Western support for it's rumoured that Russia is receiving arms from China, I beg your pardon. And there's no lessening of support by the West for Ukraine. They are making progress in the counter-offensive, but it's not as quick as the government of Ukraine or its supporters would like. It's a real slog. But that cumulative but gradual progress could take its toll on the Russians. I suppose the Ukrainians are looking for a major breakthrough around about October. The thing is that the Russians are having to defend 1,000-kilometre line of territory. So they've got quite a lot to defend, but they're well dug in. And in September, the Ukrainians will have F-16 fighter planes. So that should and could make a difference. So it looks like I can't see this war diminishing anytime soon in the next few months.
Mm. Just on that, what you were saying earlier about the sentiment within the population in Russia at the moment, do we have much of an understanding of broadly how civilians feel about this right now? Because obviously we have seen a lot of unrest within even the military at the moment. So
yes.
What
is the sentiment? Never happy, yeah. No, the military were never happy about the invasion of Ukraine.
Mm.
Nor were some of the security services. Shortly after the invasion of Ukraine, Putin arrested about 150 people in the FSB. And he's been recently sacking people in the military, many of whom are respected commanders because they were deemed sympathetic to Prigozhin, the Wagner boss who rebelled briefly against Putin. It's very difficult to measure what public opinion's like in an authoritarian state. This is a country which tells people for up to 15 years if they describe what Mr. Putin calls the special military operation in Ukraine as an invasion. So, in a sense, keeping your head down is probably the safest thing to do in Russia. And so it's very difficult to gauge. But we are seeing open acts of sabotage by Russian citizens, some of whom are quite elderly, throwing Molotov cocktails conscription offices, because the big fear at the moment is that amongst many people, is that Russia will be having a new wave of mobilization, this conscription. And of course, that's why you get people in their 60s throwing Molotov cocktails, because they may well have children or family members who could get called up. So it's a big, big concern. The other thing is about an authoritarian state, while Mr. Putin hasn't been candid or honest about the level of casualties, they are huge. Russia has lost more than 100,000 troops, and I'm being conservative here, more than 100,000 fatalities in the Russian army since the invasion over a year ago of Ukraine. And even in an authoritarian state, the word gets round, largely through rumours, what's happening.
Mm.
And that, of course, leads to a loss of support. I think Putin's in his weakest position since he launched the war, but it may be another challenge. He may well face another challenge from within Russia. It might be someone within his own circle who believes they can do a better job of Putin in prosecuting the invasion of neighboring Ukraine. I don't know, but I believe the situation for Putin is not good going forward.
Certainly a very intense time. Let's turn to AUKUS quickly, because this has been bubbling away, and I think there's still a lot of confusion perhaps about what even AUKUS is, what the whole debate has been about. This is the Australia-UK-US Defence Alliance, which was sort of tabled that New Zealand might join it. We're sort of now seeing that that's probably not going to happen. What has been, I guess, the sort of truncated version of the story, Robert? How have we got to where we are?
Right. In September 2021, a trilateral pact involving Australia, the UK and the US was established. And the acronym for that trilateral pact is AUKUS, involving Australia, the UK and the US. Their commitment was to what they call defend the international rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific and promote stability and prosperity in the region. China was never named, but it's quite clear that the new security pact that these three countries formed was clearly a response to what they saw as Chinese assertiveness in the Indo-Pacific region. And the security pact consists of two dimensions or two pillars. Pillar one involves Australia receiving 8 to 10 nuclear power submarines from its AUKUS partners during the next 3 decades. These are horrendously expensive. That will cost Australia between $268 billion to $368 billion. Pillar two involves the sharing of information in cutting-edge defense technologies. Now, we were excluded, New Zealand was excluded from AUKUS, and that suited us because we're a non-nuclear state.
Mm-hmm.
But in March, Defence Minister Little revealed that New Zealand was now exploring an invitation from the Biden administration to join Pillar 2, which would enable Wellington to access state-of-the-art defence technologies. That since then, there's been a great deal of speculation and debate on what New Zealand should do. And it now appears that the government is beginning to distance itself. Mr. Little sounded quite sort of bullish when he made the announcement that we were exploring talks or prospects of joining. Didn't commit to joining, just so we were exploring the possibility. But since then, statements by Nanai Mahuta, the foreign minister, and also Chris Hipkins, and even Mr. Little himself, suggests the government's having second thoughts and won't be proceeding down that direction.
Big part of the public discussion, as far as it's got, I guess, has been around that non-nuclear position that New Zealand has. And the suggestion that even joining Pillar 2, if that ever was to happen, would really weaken that. Do you think that's been a major part of, the pulling back of that conversation?
Yes, and I think there's been a cumulative realisation. People advocating joining have based their argument largely on the fact that the world will be determined by rivalry between the US and China, and we have to pick a side. I think when you think that thing through, that claim through, that's not necessarily going to stand up.
Mm.
The US and China are superpowers, but they don't run the world, nor can they. And most of the problems facing countries don't, these days, do not respect borders. You only have to think of climate change, pandemics like COVID-19, transnational terrorism, list goes on. So given that realisation, I think New Zealand believes on balance it's much better to sustain what's been a successful global brand, which is its non-nuclear security policy. The other thing is that New Zealand wants to diversify its trade, and many of its trade partners in ASEAN and the Pacific Island states, which we are a major region for us, they are very lukewarm about AUKUS. They see the commitment to give Australia nuclear power submarines as a potential trigger towards nuclear proliferation in the region. And therefore, they wouldn't take kindly to New Zealand being part of that arrangement, even indirectly. In other words, associate membership for New Zealand could, if you like, blur our brand as a non-nuclear, as an advocate of non-nuclear security on a global basis.
It's a very interesting. It's a very interesting thing to follow that I feel hasn't quite got enough maybe attention in the broader media. But I really appreciate you talking us through it this morning,
thank
Robert.
You.
Thank you so much for your time. We'll talk to you again
thank
in
you.
A few weeks.
Yes, thank you very much. Cheers. Bye.
Kia ora.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.